I'm Kevin March. I'm here on behalf of Christopher Hood. If I could reserve 2 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
All right.
We're asking for remand for resentencing so that the court can exercise discretion and consider whether the violation of a no-contact order and the burglary constituted the same criminal conduct under the SRA, Section 589. Here, all the court did was state that the two crimes had different intents and didn't engage in any other analysis. That was an
now abuse. We know that under Graciano, it's the court's discretion, and I mean we review for an abuse of discretion, and also it's the defendant who has the burden of proof. So, I guess we look not only at what the court said, but what was said to the court.
That's
and so, how did you prove to the court that these two crimes were the same criminal conduct?
Well, in this case, the intent of Mr. Hood when he busted open the door of his ex-wife's condo, his intent was to assault. The entering unlawfully into the condo was manifested his intent to assault, and also the violation of the no-contact order that occurred through the same act. His intent was clear, viewed objectively. His criminal purpose was to enter her apartment and assault her. That was part of the burglary, and that's actually what elevated this. The assault is what elevated this to a first-degree burglary from a residential, and the assault is also one of the alternative means that elevated the no-contact order violation from a misdemeanor to a felony. So viewed objectively, and that is the test that Washington courts use, his criminal objective in busting open the door and assaulting, busting open the door and thereby violating the no-contact order was to assault her. And the trial court did not engage in the proper analysis. It said, oh, well, the statutory elements, that's what it seems like it said, that the statutory elements are different, so no criminal conduct. That's not the proper analysis. The proper analysis is whether the crimes viewed objectively, whether the defendant's commission of the crimes does not change from one offense to the other. In this case, the answer to that question is that he had the same exact intent when he committed both crimes, which was to enter her apartment and assault her.
Is there any case on these two crimes or anything similar that you think tells us what to do in this situation in terms of
Not that I've found. However, I would note, and the state has pointed out, the burglary anti-merger statute. And when you have a burglary, the intent that is part of the burglary is always the intent to commit a crime therein. In this case, the conduct, and perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself with talking about the effect of Chenoweth that this has, but when a person enters unlawfully into a building, they're intending to commit a crime therein. The court could have found that the crime that he intended to commit therein was the violation of a no-contact order. The court could have found that that was an assault, and that's consistent with the elevation of the violation of a no-contact order from a misdemeanor to a felony. He either intended to assault or he intended to commit the violation of a no-contact order. But burglary always seems to burglary is a unique statute in that it's always the same criminal conduct. It's burglary and whatever the underlying crime that the person intends to commit therein. That's why the legislature understands this. That's why the legislature has an anti-merger statute to allow the crimes to be punished separately at its discretion. The problem here is that the trial court didn't invoke that statute, didn't give any reason for exercising or for saying that these weren't the same criminal conduct other than they had different criminal intents. And that's just not the case when we have a burglary.
But I mean, I guess the burglary anti-merger statute is basically the same thing as Graciano in the sense that it tells the court that you have the discretion.
That's correct.
All right. So actually, maybe the court has even broader discretion under the burglary anti-merger statute because you don't have to go through the same criminal conduct analysis. You don't have to find different intents. So you brought it up. Okay. So you told the court, and the court was aware of the fact that it had it could treat them either separately or not. And so the court
actually
treated them as separate.
Well, I disagree.
So you say the court said things which don't show the court's mind engaging in what was in front of it, but is that really necessary when that was in front of it?
I don't know. I don't recall that it was in front of the court, the actual burglary anti-merger statute. The court, the defense made its presentation.
I thought you cited it in order to show the court that it had the discretion to go same.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't recall that.
Okay.
But the court does have the authority under the anti-merger statute. It has the discretion, but our position is that it still didn't exercise that discretion. It just said the criminal intents are different. That's the end of the analysis, and our position is that that's not the end of the analysis. If the court wants to say I'm applying the burglary anti-merger statute and disagreeing and punishing these crimes separately, the court is empowered to do so, but our position is the record doesn't reflect that that's what the court did. So
what case, when a court has the authority that it has, it's spelled out before it, and then it gives a somewhat cursory ruling, is there a case that you are aware of which shows that that has to be reversed because the court didn't speak directly and articulately and specifically to the arguments that were raised?
I don't have such a case to...
Because the cases that say a court has to exercise its discretion are typically those in terms of sentencing where the court says, well, I always deny requests for a drug offender, sentencing alternative because I just don't think there's enough money and I don't think they work, or something like that, where the court denies that it is exercising discretion or indicates that it doesn't think it has the discretion. But that there wasn't anything like that here.
No, and again, Your Honor, our position is still that the court didn't actually exercise its discretion pursuant to the anti-merger statute. The court
what
said...
What would be the remedy that you, do you think then that we should exercise discretion, or if you were to be successful, would it be that we would send it back to the court to exercise discretion?
That's correct, that we would request resentencing so that the court could exercise its own discretion on this issue.
What were you going to say about Chenoweth?
So Chenoweth is kind of added confusion into this because it looks like now the court is looking at the statutory elements, but looking at the crime one and seeing if those elements are different than crime two. But still, we don't believe that Chenoweth changed the rule in Washington, which is you still look at the objective intent behind both crimes. You don't look at the mens rea elements of the crimes. And Chenoweth is a little bit confusing in that respect. If I could just use a few minutes of my, or a few moments of my rebuttal. In Chenoweth itself, too, the crimes at issue were third-degree child rape and incest, and those crimes themselves don't have mens rea elements. They are strict liability offenses. So the court is still engaging in the same analysis, is viewed objectively, do these two crimes further the same intent? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Joseph. I'm King County Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, appearing for the State of Washington. We're asking this court to affirm Mr. Hood's convictions and sentence. I have just a few things that I'd like to add to my the arguments that I've made in my brief, and I will start with the same criminal conduct issue. As I've argued in my brief, this court can affirm because the trial court had discretion under the burglary anti-merger statute to impose a sentence to punish each of those crimes separately. But this court can also affirm because the trial court was correct when it said that there were the intents of the two crimes were separate. Mr. March assumes that the objective intent of Mr. Hood in committing both of these crimes was to assault his ex-wife, but I don't think that that's the only possible intent that he could have had. And in fact, he had committed the crime of felony violation of a no-contact order when he approached her building, when he opened the exterior doors, or in fact, I believe, when he came within 500 feet of that building. Now, he certainly could have stopped at that point and decided to do something else, or he could have done what he had done before and vandalized her apartment. He didn't need to commit an assault in there, and that is not inherent in that crime. the burglary, of course, his intent does seem to be to assault her. But those are different intents, and so the trial court was correct in holding that because they're different intents, they are not the same criminal conduct. But in any event, because the law gives the court authority to impose a separate sentence for both of the two crimes, there's certainly no abuse of discretion here.
Well, the violation of the no contact order was a felony violation, however, and didn't it become a felony violation by virtue of the fact that he committed an assault?
There were alternative allegations, and one of them was that he had two prior convictions for no contact orders, and that was stipulated that he did have those two prior convictions.
I see.
Another point that I wanted to mention that I don't think I articulated in my brief was about, with respect to the harmless error argument on the prolonged period of time comment on the evidence, the brush instructional error. And the thing I wanted to point out is if you look at the defense argument, closing argument in that part of the trial, you can see that the prolonged period of time element was not disputed at all. Counsel argued that in fact, the counsel argued that the 1999 conviction, which was sort of the first, what kicked off this 15-year period of domestic violence, was in fact too distant, it had been too prolonged a period of time to even count that as part of the pattern. And the rest of the argument was that some of the offenses were merely proximity violations and shouldn't be considered abuse, and so that there was no pattern here. In fact, I think the quote was, in order for something to be a pattern, it has to be more than just periodic events that are separated by large expanses of time. So it wasn't whether 15 years was a prolonged period of time or not, was not something that was at issue, and that makes this case more like Levy or Levi and less like Becker. The third point that I wanted to make is with respect to the community custody statute and the argument that that is ambiguous. And I think that that is well argued in my brief, but one thing that I wanted to add is that, as you know, the rules of statutory construction and interpretation require that you read the statute so as not to render any provision superfluous. If you read, and I hope that you are following along, if you read the statute the way Mr. March suggests, then you've rendered RCW 994A701 subsection 2, which provides for an 18-month community custody period for a violent offense, you've rendered that superfluous in most cases, because in most cases, those crimes are also crimes against persons. So if they are also crimes against persons and they're not serious violent, then, you know, the argument is that they would always be subject to the lesser community custody period, in which case that second subsection is superfluous.
The comparison is made between 701 and then RCW 994A411-2, if I have the right statute.
Yes.
That is a prosecutorial filing standard statute, isn't it? How would that relate to terms of community supervision? In other words, wouldn't they have to be sort of dealing with the same topic? And this seems to me to be similar, but not the same.
Well, as you know, one of the jobs of interpreting statutes, one of the rules is that you have to look at the context of the provision and related provisions. And that is where these terms are defined, and so that is what we believe is instructive to the court.
So crime against person is defined in 411 for the rest of 994A because it's not included as a separate definition in the definitional statute?
We believe that is what applies. If the court has no further questions, I
actually have a couple of questions. One is to go back to same criminal conduct.
Yes.
I just wondered if you could confirm my understanding of the procedure, how that was argued. I understand it was raised below by the defendant at sentencing in the defense sentencing memorandum, I guess, and I have somehow gotten the impression that the court didn't call for an answer, so the state didn't answer. Is that correct?
That's correct. It came up in the sentencing hearing itself.
Did it come up verbally as well or only in the paperwork?
Verbally.
And what happened in the verbal discussion?
There was not an extensive discussion. Defense argued that I believe that the same as they do here, that the objective intent of both crimes was to assault. the victim here, and so therefore the intents were the same. The trial court did not entertain that argument for very long, and certainly. And
did the state have anything to say about it?
The court didn't actually ask the state to say anything.
So either verbally or in writing, there was no request for the state to comment.
Yes, that's my understanding.
And then one other thing I would like to bring up is the issue of the reasonable doubt instruction, which I understand that probably both parties understand that it's a Supreme Court issue. But the state in this case, and it seems like I've seen this occurring in so many other cases, I want to bring this up, is that there seems to be a real attack here on invited error by the state, trying to avoid having these arguments even considered when there's any hint that the defendant failed to object or somehow, see, I guess in this case, the judge said something about maybe there was a stipulation. So, I mean, I'm just questioning that, really, because I guess I've always understood that in criminal cases, invited error, and perhaps in civil cases as well, but there has to be some affirmative request where the defendant says, I want this particular instruction to be given, I'm submitting it. And then on appeal says, oh, but that was a faulty instruction. Okay, right. That's the classic case for invited error. When you get into these other situations where the defendant doesn't offer instructions but just accepts them or remains silent in some way, do you propose that that also is invited error?
No. I agree that there needs to be an affirmative adoption of the instructions that are offered by the state. But I believe that was done in this case. Now, we don't have anything in the record with counsel saying, I affirmatively adopt the state's submissions. But you do have in the record the court saying, it's my understanding that defense has stipulated to the state's instruction, and later that the defense has joined with the state's instructions. Presumably, if they did not, or if they had any argument with the instructions at all, they would have jumped in at that point and say, no, Your Honor.
But not having any argument at the time with the state's instructions, isn't that different from, I want the court to give these instructions?
Well, when it's my position that when the defense joins the state's submission, which there saves them some work in complying with their criminal rule 6.15 obligation to provide instructions, that I've lost my train of thought there. But when they affirmatively make that adoption, that they are adopting those instructions as their own. Now, Mr. March.
Now, what case says that under 6.15 a defendant shirks their duty if they don't provide a complete set of instructions?
Criminal Rule 6.5 doesn't distinguish.
Case law.
I don't have case law for that. Okay. I didn't find a case
so
law.
So the
that.
Rule says?
The rule says that without distinguishing between which party, all parties shall provide instructions, jury instructions to the court by a certain amount of time. It is quite common for defense counsel not to wish to do that, and we have Mr. March's interesting argument that a defense counsel would actually be constitutionally ineffective per se by either adopting the state's instructions or, if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, by proposing any instructions. I think that's a problematic standard and that this court should not adopt. The criminal rules and, of course, concerns about judicial resources.
Yeah, but that's a different question from whether we would interpret the rule that you just cited as saying that you have to propose a complete set of instructions, which often doesn't happen and seems like it would be a big waste of time.
Well, parties can save time by adopting one another's instructions.
Well, they can also save time by not proposing the instructions if they know that there's already been an instruction proposed by another side.
That's right. And that's why I believe that the court's representation that the defense counsel has stipulated to and joined with the instructions makes it clear that they did, in fact, adopt those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'll go ahead and address this invited error issue with regard to the instruction. Our position is that defense counsel should propose any of those instructions that are necessary for defense counsel to argue its theory of the case, but duplicating the state's instructions or joining the state's instructions only serves to burden your client's future claims. And this is a tactic that King County has been using consistently. They are attempting to get defense counsel to stipulate to its or join its submission of jury instructions to curb any appellate claims, any appellate challenges to instructional to the instructions under the invited error doctrine. So the King County Prosecutor's Office is really engaged in this tactic to force defense counsel, trial counsel, to invite error. We believe that it is ineffective assistance of counsel because there's no reasonable strategy that could explain harming one's client and burdening one's client's future appellate claims from judicial review on appeal. So with that, we would ask this court to reverse. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.